Chapter 7 Resisting 33 Sam Aikman said, "Play the bastard's call one more time, will you, Jerry?" Hoskins slipped the transcript cube into the access slot. On the screen, at the front end of the boardroom, Bruce Mannheim's face appeared, reproduced just as it had been on the screen of Hoskins' own telephone at the time of the call, an insistently blinking green rosette at the lower right-hand corner of the screen, signaled that the call had been recorded with the knowledge and permission of the caller. Mannheim was a youngish, full-faced man with dense waves of thick red hair clinging close to his scalp and a ruddy, florid complexion. Though beards had been out of fashion for some years, except among extremely young men and very old ones, he wore a short, neatly trimmed goatee and a bushy little mustache. The well-known advocate for the rights of children looked very sincere, very earnest, very serious. To Hoskins, he also looked very annoying. On screen, Mannheim said, "The situation is, Dr. Hoskins, that our most recent discussion was not at all fruitful, and I simply can't take your word any longer that the boy is being held under acceptable conditions." "Why?" the Hoskins on the screen replied. "Has my word suddenly become untrustworthy?" "That's not the point, Doctor. We have no reason to doubt your word. But we have no reason to take it at face value either. And some members of my advisory board have begun to feel that I've been too willing up to now to accept your own evaluations of the boy's status. The point is that there's been no on-site inspection." "You speak of the child as though he's some kind of hidden weapon, Mr. Mannheim." Mannheim smiled, but there wasn't much amusement visible in his pale gray eyes. "Please understand my position. I'm under considerable pressure from the sector of public opinion that I represent, Dr. Hoskins. Despite all your publicity releases, many people continue to feel that a child who was brought here as this one was, and who is kept in what amounts to solitary confinement for an indefinite period, is a child who is being subjected to cruel and inhuman punishment. You and I have been through all this more than once," said Hoskins. "The child is receiving the best care in the world, and you know it. He has 24-hour-a-day nursing attention and daily medical checkups, and he's on a perfectly balanced diet that has already done wonders for his physical condition. We'd be crazy to do things any other way, and whatever else we may be, we aren't crazy."
"I grant you that you've told me all that, but you still aren't allowing any outside confirmation of the things you claim. And the letters and calls that I'm receiving daily, the outcries, the pressure from concerned individuals. If you're under pressure, Mr. Mannheim," said Hoskins unceremoniously, "may I suggest that it's because you've stirred this matter up by yourself in the first place, and now your own people are turning on you a little of the heat that you single-handedly chose to generate?"
"That's the way to talk to him, Jerry boy," said Charlie McDermott, the comptroller.
"Maybe a bit on the blunt side, seems to me," Ned Cassaday said. He was the head of legal. It was his job to err on the side of prudence. The recorded conversation was proceeding on the screen.
"Neither here nor there, Dr. Hoskins. We have to keep returning to one basic point here, which is that a child has been ripped away from his parents and his home. A Neanderthal child, Mr. Mannheim. Neanderthal man was a primitive, savage, nomadic form of humanity. It's anybody's guess whether or not Neanderthals had homes of any real sort, or even that they understood the concept of the parent-child relationship as we know it. For all we know, we may have pulled this child out of an absolutely brutish, hostile, miserable existence. Much more likely, I'd say, than the picture you offer of our callously yanking him out of his idyllic little Christmas card family life back there in the Pleistocene."
"Are you telling me that Neanderthals are no more than animals?" Mannheim asked. "That the child you've brought back from the Pleistocene is actually just some kind of ape that walks on his hind legs?"
"Certainly not. We aren't trying to pretend anything of the sort. Neanderthals were primitive, but they were unquestionably human. Because if you're going to try to claim that your captive has no human rights because he isn't human, Dr. Hoskins, then I must point out that scientists are completely unanimous in their belief that Homo neanderthalensis is in fact simply a subspecies of our own race, Homo sapiens, and therefore...
Jesus suffering Christ!
Hoskins exploded. Aren't you listening to me at all? I just got through saying that we concede the point that Timmy is human.
Timmy? Mannheim said. The child has been nicknamed Timmy around here, yes. It's been in all the news reports.
From the sidelines, Ned Cassaday murmured, which was probably a mistake. Creates too much identification with the child as child per se. You give them names, you start making them seem too real in the eyes of the public. And then, if there happens to be any sort of trouble, the child is real, Ned, Hoskins said. And there's not going to be any trouble. On screen, Mannheim was saying, Very well, Doctor. We both agree that we're talking about a human child, and we have no real disagreement on another basic point, which, as I said a few moments back, is that you've taken custody of this child by your own decision, and you have no legal claim to him. You've essentially kidnapped this child, I could quite accurately say.
Legal claim? What legality? Where? Tell me what laws I've broken. Show me the Pleistocene court where I can be brought to justice.
The fact that Pleistocene people have no courts doesn't mean that they have no rights, said Mannheim smoothly. You'll notice that I use the present tense to refer to these extinct people. Now that time travel has become a working reality, everything is present tense. If we are capable of intruding on the lives of people who lived 40,000 years ago, then we must of necessity extend to those people the same human rights and courtesies that we regard as inalienable in our own society. You certainly wouldn't try to tell me that Stasis Technologies Limited would have the right to reach into some village in contemporary Brazil or Zaire or Indonesia and simply seize any child it felt like seizing purely for the sake of... This is a unique experiment of immense scientific importance, Mr. Mannheim. Hoskins sputtered. Now I think you're failing to listen to me, Dr. Hoskins. I'm not discussing motive. I'm discussing simple legality. Even for the sake of scientific research, would you feel justified in swooping down on some child in his native village, in some present-day tribal culture, and bringing him here so that anthropologists could study him, regardless of the feelings of the child's parents or other guardians? Of course not. But tribal cultures of the past are fair game. Hoskins said, There's no analogy. The past is a closed book. The child now in our custody has been dead, Mr. Mannheim, for 40,000 years. Ned Cassaday let out a gasp and began to shake his head violently. It struck Hoskins that Cassaday must see novel and disturbing legal ramifications here that probably should never have been allowed into the discussion. Mannheim said, I see. The child is dead, but he receives round-the-clock nursing care? Come, Moffat, Dr. Hoskins, your reasoning's absurd. In the era of time travel, the old distinctions between dead and alive no longer have the same validity. You've opened the closed book that you just spoke of, and you can't just close it again by your own say-so. Like it or not, we live in an age of paradox now. The child's as alive as you and I, now that you've moved him from his proper era to our own, and we both agree that he's human and deserving of the sort of treatment that any child is entitled to. And that brings us right back to the question of the care he's receiving while he's here among us. Call him a kidnap victim. Call him the subject of a unique scientific experiment. Call him an involuntary guest in our era. Whatever semantic spin you want to put on things. All that really matters is that you've arbitrarily removed the child from his native environment without the consent of anybody concerned, and you're keeping him locked up in some kind of containment unit. Must we continue to go around in circles? There's only one issue here. You know what it is. I represent a large body of concerned opinion, and I've been asked to ascertain that the human rights of this unfortunate child are being properly respected. I object to your use of the word unfortunate. I've made it clear again and again that the child is...
All right. I retract the word if it bothers you so much. The rest of my statement stands as is. Hoskins said, making no attempt to conceal his thinning patience,
What is it specifically that you want from us, Mr. Mannheim?
I've told you. On-site inspection, so that we can see the child's condition and attitude for ourselves. The on-screen Hoskins closed his eyes a moment.
You're very persistent, aren't you? Nothing will please you short of coming in here and checking things out in person.
You know the answer to that.
Well, I'll have to get back to you, Mr. Mannheim. We've been allowing only qualified scientific investigators to see Timmy up till this point, and I'm not sure you fit that category. I'll need to convene a meeting of my advisory board to discuss all this. Thank you very much for calling, Mr. Mannheim. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
The screen went dark. Hoskins looked around the room.
Well, there it is. You see the problem? He's like a bulldog who's got his teeth in the cuff of my pants. He won't let go no matter how I try to shake him off,
Ned Cassaday said. And if you do manage somehow to shake the bulldog off, he'll come right at you again, and this time the teeth very likely will clamp onto your leg, Jerry, not just your pants cuff.
What are you telling me, Ned?
That we ought to let him have his on-site inspection, as a gesture of goodwill.
That's your considered legal opinion?
Cassaday nodded.
You've been stonewalling this guy for weeks now, right? He calls, you give him a runaround, he calls again, you find some new way of deflecting his arguments, and so on, and so on, and so on. But you can't keep it up forever. He's just as stubborn as you are, and the difference is that in his case, stubbornness looks like dedication to a worthy cause, and in your case, it looks like willful obstructionism. This is the first time he's actually asked to set foot on the premises, isn't it?
Right, Hoskins said. You see, he can always keep coming up with new maneuvers, and you can't counter this one with more press releases or another interview with Candide Devaney on the sub-etheric. Mannheim will go public right away with claims that there's a cover-up going on here, that we have something terrible to hide. Let him come and see the little boy. It might just shut him up long enough for us to get our work on this project finished.
Sam Aikman shook his head. I don't think there's a reason in the world why we need to cave into that colossal pain in the neck, Ned. If we were keeping the kid chained up in a closet, maybe. If he was just a miserable, sickly bag of bones with pimples and scurvy who cries bloody murder all day and all night. But the kid is flourishing, according to Jerry. He's putting on a little weight. I hear that he's even learning to speak some English. He's never had it so good, and that ought to be obvious, even to Bruce Mannheim.
Exactly, Cassaday said. We don't have anything to hide. So why should we give Mannheim the chance to make it seem as though we do?
Good point, said Hoskins. He glanced around the room. I'd like a show of opinion on this. Do we invite Mannheim here to see Timmy, or don't we?
I say to hell with him, Sam Aikman said. He's nothing more than a pest. No reason in the world why we should cave into him.
I'm with Ned Cassaday, said Frank Bruton.
Let him come in so we can get this over with.
It's risky, said Charlie McDermott. Once he's in the door, there's no telling what further issues he'll raise. As Ned says, there's always some new maneuver. Allowing him to visit the boy won't get him off our backs and might just make the situation worse for us. I say no.
What about you, Elena? Hoskins said, turning toward Elena Sadler, who ran Materiel's procurement.
I vote for letting him come. As Ned says, we've got nothing to hide. We can't let this man go on smearing us the way he's done. Once he's been here, it's simply his word against ours, and we've got our televised glimpses of Timmy to show the world that we're right and he's wrong.
Hoskins nodded glumly. Two for it, two against. So I get to cast the deciding vote.
Okay, so be it. I'll tell Mannheim he can come,
Aikman said.
Jerry, are you sure you want to...
Yes, said Hoskins. I don't like him any more than you do, Sam, or want him sniffing around this place for so much as 2 minutes. He's a pest, just as you say, and it's precisely because he is such a pest that I've come around to thinking we'd better give him his way. Let him see Timmy, thriving and flourishing. Let him meet Miss Fellows, and find out for himself whether there's any sort of child abuse going on around here. I agree with Ned that the visit might just shut him up. If it doesn't, well, we're no worse off than we are now. He'll continue to agitate and howl, and we'll continue to deny all his accusations. But if we simply refuse his request to visit, he'll wrap all sorts of bizarre new charges around our necks, and God only knows what we'll have to do to counter them. So my vote is for tossing the bulldog a bone. That way we stand a chance against him. The other way, we're sunk. Mannheim gets an invitation to come here, and so be it. Meeting adjourned. 34. Miss Fellows was giving Timmy his bath when the intercom sounded in the next room. The interruption drew a scowl from her. She looked at the boy in the tub. Bath time was no longer an ordeal for him. It was more like sport. He looked forward to it every day. The sensation of lying half-submerged in warm water no longer was threatening to him. Plainly, it was a wondrous, luxurious treat for him. Not only the feel of the warm water itself, but the delight of coming forth pink, clean, sweet-smelling. And, of course, there was the fun of doing a little splashing around. The longer he lived here, the more like an ordinary little boy Timmy was coming to seem, Miss Fellows thought. But she didn't like the idea of leaving him in the tub for long, unattended. Not that she worried much about his drowning. Little boys his age didn't generally drown in their tubs, and this one seemed to have a healthy enough sense of self-preservation. But if he decided to get out on his own and somehow slipped and fell, she said, "I'll be right back, Timmy. You stay in the tub by yourself, all right?" He nodded. "Stay in the tub. In the tub, you understand?" "Yes, Miss Fellows." Nobody in the world would have recognized the sound Timmy had uttered as being, "Yes, Miss Fellows." Nobody but Miss Fellows. Still a little uneasy, she hurried into the other room and said to the intercom vent, "Who's calling?" "It's Dr. Hoskins, Miss Fellows. I'd like to know if Timmy can stand another visitor this afternoon." "He's supposed to have free time this afternoon. I'm already giving him his bath. He never has visitors after he's had his bath." "Yes, I know. This is a special case." Miss Fellows listened for sounds from the bathroom. Timmy was splashing around vociferously and obviously having a wonderful time. She heard the boys' pealing laughter. She said reproachfully, "They're all special cases, aren't they, Dr. Hoskins? If I let everybody in here who was some sort of special case, the boy would be on display to special cases all day and all night, too."
"This one is really special, Miss Fellows."
"I'd still rather not. Timmy's entitled to some time off, just like anyone else. And if you don't mind, Dr. Hoskins, I'd like to get back to his bath before..."
"The visitor is Bruce Mannheim, Miss Fellows."
"What?"
"You're aware that Mannheim's been plaguing us with his standard sort of trumped-up charges and inflammatory nonsense practically from the moment we announced that Timmy was here, aren't you?"
"I suppose so," Miss Fellows said.
She hadn't actually been paying much attention.
"Well, he's been calling here about every third day to register this or that expression of outrage. And finally, I asked him what he wants from us, and he said he insists on on-site inspection." That was the term he used, on-site inspection, of Timmy. "As if we had some sort of missile emplacement here. We aren't enthusiastic about it, but we had a board meeting and decided finally that it would do more harm than good to refuse. I'm afraid there's no choice, Miss Fellows. We have to let him come in."
"Today?"
"About 2 hours from now. He's a very insistent man." "You could have given me a little more notice."
"I would have if I could, Miss Fellows. But Mannheim caught me by surprise when I called him to say we'd let him in. He told me he'd be right over. And when I said I wasn't sure that was workable, he started in again on all his suspicions and accusations. I think he was implying that we were playing for time, so we'd be able to cover up all of the bruises Timmy has from the whippings we give him, or some such crazy thing. In any case,
He also said that he'd be going before the monthly meeting of his board of directors tomorrow, and that this would be a fine chance for him to report to them on Timmy's condition, and therefore... Hoskins let his voice trail off. I know it's short notice, Miss Fellows. Please don't put up a fuss, all right? Please. She felt a burst of pity for him. Caught between the tireless political agitator on the one hand and the ill-tempered gorgon of a nurse on the other, the poor, weary man. All right, Dr. Hoskins, she said, just this once. I'll see what I can do about having all the bruises covered over with makeup before he gets here. She went back to the bathroom while Hoskins' gratitude was still coming out of the intercom. Timmy was busy conducting a naval battle between a green plastic duck and a purple plastic sea monster. The duck seemed to be winning. You're going to have company this afternoon, Miss Fellows told the boy. She was bubbling over with fury. A man's coming here to check up on us, to see whether we've been mistreating you, if you can believe that. Mistreating. Timmy gave her a blank look. His fledgling vocabulary didn't stretch anywhere nearly that far. Miss Fellows hadn't really expected it to. Who coming? He asked. A man, she said. A visitor. Timmy nodded. Nice visitor? Let's hope so. Come on now. It's time to get you out of the tub and dry you off. More bath, more bath. More bath tomorrow. Come on now, Timmy. Reluctantly, he clambered out of the tub. Miss Fellows toweled him off and gave him a quick inspection. No whip marks showing, no sign of damage at all. The boy was in fine shape, especially when she compared him with the filthy, scruffy, bruised, and scratched child who had tumbled out of the stasis scoop amidst a mass of dirt and pebbles and ants and chunks of grass on that first strange, frightening night. Timmy was glowing with good health. He had gained several pounds since then. His scratches had healed, and his assortment of bruises had vanished long ago. His hair was neatly cut, his fingernails were trimmed. Let Bruce Mannheim try to find something to complain about. Let him try. Ordinarily, she would have put Timmy into his pajamas after the bath, but everything was changed now because of the visitor who was coming, the very special visitor. That called for formal dress. The purple overalls with the red buttons, Miss Fellows thought. Timmy grinned when he saw them. They were his favorite overalls, too. And now, I think, a nice little snack before the company gets here. What do you say to that, Timmy? She was still shaking with anger. Bruce Mannheim, she thought, icily. That busybody, that troublemaker. A children's advocate, he called himself. Who had ever asked him to advocate anything? A professional agitator, that was all he was, a public nuisance. Miss Fellows? Hoskins' voice was coming through on the intercom again. What is it, Doctor? Mr. Mannheim isn't due here for another half hour, I thought. He's early, Hoskins said. That's the sort of person he is, I'm afraid. There was something strangely sheepish about his voice. And I'm afraid that he's brought someone with him, too, without telling us he was going to. Two visitors is too many, Miss Fellows said adamantly. I know. Please, Miss Fellows, I had no idea he was bringing someone else. But Mannheim's pretty insistent on having her see Timmy with him. And now that we've gone this far, the risk of offending him, you see? So he was begging again. This Mannheim really had him terrified. Where was the strong and indomitable Dr. Gerald Hoskins she once had known? And who's this other person? She asked after a moment. This unexpected guest? An associate of his, a consultant to his organization. You may even know her. You probably do. She's an expert on troubled children. Someone mixed up with all sorts of governmental commissions and institutions. A very high-profile individual. She was even under consideration for a while, I should tell you, for the very job you have today, although I felt, that she didn't quite have the kind of warmth and sympathy we were looking for. Her name's Marianne Levian. I think she might be a little dangerous. The last thing we can risk is to turn her away at the entrance now that she's here. Miss Fellows put her hand over her mouth in horror.
Marianne Levian, she thought, aghast. God preserve me. God preserve us all. 35. The oval door to the dollhouse opened, and Hoskins came in, with two figures close behind him. Hoskins looked dreadful. His fleshy face seemed to be sagging, so that he appeared to have aged 10 years in a day. His skin was leaden. His eyes had an oddly defeated, almost cowed expression that Miss Fellows found strange and frightening. She scarcely recognized him. What was going on? He said in a low, uneasy tone, "This is Edith Fellows, Timmy's nurse. Bruce Mannheim, Miss Fellows, Marianne Levian."
"And this is Timmy?" Mannheim asked.
"Yes,"
Miss Fellows said, booming the word out to make up for Hoskins' sudden diffidence.
"This is Timmy."
The boy had been in the back room, his bedroom and playroom, but he had tentatively poked forward when he had heard the visitors entering. Now he came toward them in a steady, bouncy, outgoing stride that drew a silent cheer from Miss Fellows.
"You show them, Timmy. Are we mistreating you? Are you hiding under your bed, quivering with fear and misery?"
Resplendent in his finest overalls, the boy marched up to the newcomers and stared up at them in frank curiosity.
"Good for you," Miss Fellows thought, "and good for all of us."
"Well," Mannheim said, "so you're Timmy."
"Timmy,"
said Timmy, though Miss Fellows was the only one in the room who realized that that was what he was saying. The boy reached upward toward Mannheim. Mannheim evidently thought he wanted to shake hands, and offered his own. But Timmy didn't know anything about handshakes. He avoided Mannheim's outstretched hand, and waggled his own in an impatient little side-to-side gesture, while continuing to strain upward as far as he could. Mannheim seemed puzzled.
"Your hair," this fellow said. "I suspect he's never seen anyone with red hair before. They must not have had it in Neanderthal times, and no redheads have visited him here. Fair hair of any sort appears to fascinate him tremendously."
"Ah," Mannheim said, "so that's it."
He grinned and knelt, and Timmy immediately dug his fingers into Mannheim's thick, springy crop of hair. Not only the color, but also the coiling texture of it must have been new to him, and he explored it thoughtfully. Mannheim tolerated it with great good humor. He was, Miss Fellows found herself conceding, not at all what she had imagined. She had expected him to be some sort of wild-eyed, fire-breathing radical who would immediately begin issuing denunciations, manifestos, and uncompromising demands for reform. But he was turning out, in fact, to be rather pleasant and gentle, a thoughtful and serious-looking man, younger than she had expected, who seemed to be losing no time making friends with Timmy. Marianne Levian, though, was a very different sort of item. Even Timmy, when he had grown tired of examining Bruce Mannheim's hair and had turned to get a look at the other visitor, seemed hard-pressed to know what to make of her. Miss Fellows had already formed her opinion. She disliked Levian on sight, and she suspected that it was Levian's unexpected arrival, rather than the presence of Bruce Mannheim, that was causing Dr. Hoskins such obvious distress. "What is she doing here?" Miss Fellows wondered. "What kind of trouble is she planning to make for us?" Levian was known far and wide through the child care profession as an ambitious, aggressive, controversial woman, highly skilled at self-promotion and the steady advancement of her career. Miss Fellows had never actually come face to face with her before. But as the nurse looked at her now, Levian appeared every bit as formidable and disagreeable as her reputation suggested. She seemed more like an actress or a businesswoman, or like an actress playing the role of a businesswoman, than any sort of child care specialist. She was wearing some slinky, shimmering dress made from close-woven strands of metallic fabric, with a huge, blazing, golden pendant in the form of a sun on her breast, and a band of intricately woven gold around her broad forehead. Her hair was dark and shining, pulled back tight to make her look all the more dramatic. Her lips were bright red, her eyes were flamboyantly encircled with makeup. An invisible cloud of perfume surrounded her. Miss Fellows stared at her in distaste. It was hard to imagine how Dr. Hoskins could have considered this woman
even for a fraction of a second, as a potential nurse for Timmy. She was Miss Fellows' antithesis in every respect. And why, Miss Fellows wondered, had Marianne Levian been interested in the job in the first place? It required seclusion and total dedication, whereas Levian, Miss Fellows knew, was forever on the go, constantly buzzing all around the world to scientific meetings, standing up and offering firmly held opinions that other people of greater experience tended to find controversial and troublesome. She was full of startling ideas about how to use advanced technology to rehabilitate difficult children, substituting wondrous, glittering, futuristic machinery for the down-to-earth love and devotion that had usually managed to do the job throughout most of humanity's existence. And she was an adept politician, too, always turning up on this committee or that, consultant to one or another influential task force, popping up everywhere in all manner of significant capacities. A highly visible person, rising like a rocket in her profession. If she had wanted the job here that Miss Fellows ultimately had gained, it must only have been because she saw it somehow as the springboard to very much bigger things. I must be very old-fashioned, Miss Fellows thought. All I saw was a chance to do some good for an unusual little boy who needed an unusual amount of loving care. Timmy put out his hand toward Marianne Levian's shimmering metallic dress. His eyes were glowing with delight.
"Pretty,"
he said. Levian stepped back quickly out of his reach.
"What did he say?"
"He admires your dress," Miss Fellows said. "He just wants to touch it."
"I'd rather he didn't. It's easily damaged."
"You'd better watch out, then. He's very quick."
"Pretty,"
Timmy said again.
"Want?"
"No, Timmy. No, mustn't touch."
"Want?"
"I'm sorry. No. N-O. Timmy gave her an unhappy look, but he made no second move toward Marianne Levian.
"Does he understand you?" Mannheim asked.
"Well, he isn't touching the dress, is he?" said Miss Fellows, smiling.
"And you can understand him?"
"Some of the time. Much of the time."
"Those grunts of his," said Marianne Levian. "What do you think they could have meant?"
"He said, 'Pretty, your dress.' Then he said, 'Want.' To touch, he meant."
"He was speaking English?" Mannheim asked in surprise.
"I wouldn't have guessed. His articulation isn't good, probably for some physiological reason. But I can understand him. He's got a vocabulary of, about 100 English words, I'd say, maybe a little more. He learns a few every day. He picks them up on his own by this time. He's probably about 4 years old, you realize. Even though he's getting such a late start, he's got the normal linguistic ability that you'd expect in a child of his age, and he's catching up in a hurry."
"You say that a Neanderthal child has the same linguistic ability as a human child?"
Marianne Levian asked.
"He is a human child."
"Yes, yes, of course,
but different. A separate subspecies, isn't that so? And therefore it would be reasonable to expect differences in mental aptitude that could be as considerable as the differences in physical appearance. His extremely primitive facial structure," Miss Fellows said sharply.
"It's not all that primitive, Ms. Levian. Go look at a chimpanzee sometime if you want to see what a truly subhuman face is like. Timmy has some unusual anatomical features, but..."
"You used the word subhuman, not me,"
Levian said.
"But you were thinking it."
"Miss Fellows! Dr. Levian, please! There's no need for such rancor."
"Dr. Levian?"
Miss Fellows thought, with a quick glance at Hoskins. "Well, yes, yes, probably so," Mannheim said, glancing around. "These little rooms here, this is the boy's entire living environment?"
"That's correct," Miss Fellows replied. "That's his bedroom and playroom back there. He takes his meals here, and that's his bathroom. I have my own living area over here, and these are the storage facilities."
"He never goes beyond this enclosed area?"
"No,"
Miss Fellows said. "This is the stasis bubble. He doesn't leave the bubble, not ever. A very confining sort of life, wouldn't you agree? Hoskins said quickly, too quickly, It's an absolutely necessary confinement. There are technical reasons for it, having to do with the build-up of temporal potential involved in bringing the boy across time, that I could explain in detail if you wanted the full background. But what it comes down to is that the energy cost of allowing the boy to cross the stasis boundary would be prohibitive. So to save a little money, you plan to keep him cooped up in these few small rooms indefinitely? Levian asked.
Not just a little money, Dr. Levian, Hoskins said, looking more harried than ever. I said that the cost would be prohibitive. It goes even beyond cost. The available metropolitan energy supply would have to be diverted in a way that I think would cause insuperable problems for the entire utility district. There's no problem when you or I or Miss Fellows cross the stasis line, but for Timmy to do it would be, well, simply not possible. Simply not possible.
If science can find a way to bring a child across 40,000 years of time, Marianne Levian said grandly, science can find a way to make it possible for him to walk down that hallway if he wanted to.
I wish that were true, Dr. Levian, Hoskins said.
So the child is permanently restricted to these rooms, said Mannheim. And if I understand you rightly, no research is currently underway to find a way around that problem?
That's correct. As I've tried to explain, it can't be done. Not within the real-world considerations that we have to put up with. We want the boy to be comfortable, but we simply can't divert our resources into trying to solve insoluble problems. As I told you, I can provide you later on with the full technical analysis if you want to check it over.
Mannheim nodded. He seemed to be checking something off on some list he kept in his mind.
Levian said, What sort of diet is the boy on?
Would you like to examine the pantry? Miss Fellows asked, in no very friendly way.
Yes, as a matter of fact, yes, I would.
Miss Fellows made a sweeping gesture toward the refrigeration cabinets. Take a good look, she thought. I think you'll be happy when you do. Indeed, Levian seemed pleased by what she found. A bunch of vials and ampoules and drip globes and mixation pods. The entire inhuman assortment of synthetic diets, so remote from anything that Miss Fellows thought of as wholesome food that Dr. Jacobs and his associates had insisted Timmy had to eat against Miss Fellows' vehement objections. Levian prowled through the racks of high-tech foodstuffs with evident approval. It was just the kind of super-futuristic stuff she'd be likely to go for, Miss Fellows thought angrily. She probably ate nothing but synthetics herself. If she ate anything at all.
No complaints there,
Levian said after a time.
Your nutrition people seem to know what they're doing.
The boy does appear healthy, said Mannheim, but I'm concerned about this enforced solitude of his.
Yeah,
Marianne Levian chimed in.
So am I, very much so.
Mannheim said, It's bad enough that he's being deprived of the support of tribal structures into which he was born. But the fact that Timmy has to do without companionship of any sort does indeed seem extremely troublesome to me.
Don't I count as companionship, Mr. Mannheim?
Miss Fellows asked, with some asperity.
I'm with him virtually all the time, you know.
I was referring to the need for someone close to his own age, a playmate. This experiment is planned to run for a considerable length of time, Dr. Hoskins, is it not?
There's a great deal we hope to learn from Timmy about the era from which he comes. As his command of English improves, and Miss Fellows assures me that he's becoming quite fluent, even though it's not easy for some of us to make out exactly what he's saying.
In other words, you intend to keep him here for a period of some years, Dr. Hoskins?
Marianne Levian said.
That could be, yes.
Mannheim said, Perpetually penned up in a few small rooms, and never being exposed to contact with children of his own age. Is that any kind of life for a healthy young boy like Timmy, do you think?
Hoskins' eyes moved quickly from one to the other. He looked outnumbered and beleaguered.
He said,
Miss Fellows has already brought up the issue of getting a playmate for Timmy. I assure you that we've got no desire whatever to cripple the boy's emotional development or any other aspect of his existence. Miss Fellows glanced at him in surprise. She had brought the issue up, yes, but nothing had come of it. Since that one inconclusive conversation in the company cafeteria, Hoskins hadn't said the slightest thing to her in response to her request that Timmy be given a child to keep him company. He had brushed the idea off, then, as unworkable, and he had seemed so taken aback by the whole notion, in fact, that Miss Fellows had hesitated to bring it up with him a second time. For the moment, Timmy had been getting along quite satisfactorily on his own. But lately, she had begun to look ahead, thinking that Timmy's adaptation to modern life was proceeding so quickly that the moment to raise the point again with Hoskins was approaching. And now, Mannheim was raising it first, for which Miss Fellows was immensely grateful. The children's advocate was absolutely right. Timmy couldn't be kept in here all by himself, like an ape in a cage. Timmy wasn't an ape. Even a gorilla or a chimpanzee wouldn't do well cut off indefinitely from the society of his peers. Mannheim said, "Well, then, if you've already been working on getting a companion for him, I'd like to know what progress has been made along those lines." Suddenly his tone was no longer so amiable. Sounding flustered, Hoskins said, "So far as bringing a second Neanderthal back to the present time to put in here with Timmy goes, which was Miss Fellows' original suggestion, I have to tell you that we simply don't intend..." "A second Neanderthal?" "Oh, no, Dr. Hoskins," said Mannheim. "We wouldn't want that at all."
"It's a serious enough matter that there's one already incarcerated here,"
Marianne Levian said.
"To capture a second one would only compound the problem."
Hoskins shot her a venomous glare. Sweat was streaming down his face.
"I said that we don't intend to bring a second Neanderthal here," he replied, virtually between clenched teeth. "That's never been under consideration, never. There are a dozen different reasons why. When Miss Fellows brought it up the first time, I told her..."
Mannheim and Levian exchanged glances. They appeared bothered by Hoskins' sudden vehemence. Even Timmy began to seem a little alarmed, and moved up close against Miss Fellows' side as though seeking protection. Smoothly, Mannheim said, "We're all agreed, Dr. Hoskins, that a second Neanderthal would be a bad idea. That's not the point at all. What we want to know is whether it would be possible for Timmy to be given a... well, what word do I want? Not human, because Timmy is human, but modern, a modern playmate, a child of this era."
"A child who could visit Timmy on a regular basis," said Marianne Levian, "and provide him with the kind of developmental stimuli that would tend to further the healthy sociocultural assimilation which we all agree is necessary."
"Just a minute," Hoskins snapped. "What assimilation? Are you imagining a pleasant future life in some cozy little suburb for Timmy? Applying for American citizenship, joining a church, settling down and getting married? May I remind you that what we have here is a prehistoric child from an era so remote that we can't even call it barbaric. A Stone Age child, a visitor from what you yourself, Dr. Levian, once described with some accuracy as an alien society. And you think he's going to become..." Levian cut in coolly.
"Timmy's hypothetical citizenship application and church membership aren't the issue, Dr. Hoskin, or any other such reductio ad absurdum. Timmy is still a child, and it's the quality of the childhood that he experiences that Mr. Mannheim and I are primarily concerned with. The conditions under which he's being held, as of now, are unacceptable. They would, I'm sure, have been unacceptable in Timmy's own society, however alien from ours in some respects it must surely have been. Every human society we know, no matter how remote its paradigms and parameters may be from ours, assures its children the right to a nurturing integration into its social matrix. There's no way that we can regard Timmy's present living conditions as providing him with that sort of adequately nurturant social matrix." Acidly, Hoskins said,
which means, in words of one syllable comprehensible by a mere physicist like myself, Dr. Levian, that you think Timmy ought to have a playmate.
Not merely ought to, Levian said. Must.
I'm afraid we're going to take the position that companionship for the child is essential, said Mannheim in a less belligerent tone than Levian's.
Essential, Hoskins repeated bleakly.
A minimum first step, Levian said. This is not to say that we are prepared to regard the boy's incarceration in our era for a prolonged period as acceptable or permissible. But for the moment at least, we think we can waive our other outstanding objections, and therefore the experiment can be permitted to continue. Is that not so, Mr. Mannheim?
Permitted? Hoskins cried.
Provided, Marianne Levian continued serenely, that Timmy be allowed the opportunity to enjoy regular and emotionally nourishing contact with other children of his chronological peer group.
Hoskins looked toward Miss Fellows for some sort of support under this onslaught, but she could offer him no help.
I have to agree, Dr. Hoskins, said Miss Fellows, feeling like a traitor. I felt this way all along, and it's becoming more urgent now. The boy's coming along very nicely indeed, but the point is close at hand. We're continuing to live in this kind of social vacuum. Will be very bad for him. And since there aren't going to be any other children of Timmy's own subspecies available to him.
Hoskins turned to her as if to say, you're against me, too. There was silence for a moment in the room. Timmy, who seemed increasingly disturbed by the vociferousness of the discussion, clung ever tighter to Miss Fellows. At length, Hoskins said, those are your terms, Mr. Mannheim? Dr. Levian? A playmate for Timmy, or you'll bring your hordes of protesters down on my head? Mannheim said, no threats are being made, Dr. Hoskins. But even your own Miss Fellows sees the need for implementing our recommendation.
Right. And you think it'll be easy to find people who will cheerfully let their young children come in here and play with a little Neanderthal? With all those fantastic notions circulating out there about how savage and ferocious and primitive Neanderthal man must have been?
It should be no harder, Mannheim said, than being able to bring a little Neanderthal child into the 21st century in the first place. A good deal easier, I'd like to think.
I can imagine what our counsel would have to say about that. The cost of liability insurance alone, assuming we can find anyone crazy enough to allow their child inside the stasis bubble with Timmy.
Timmy doesn't seem all that ferocious to me, said Mannheim. He seems quite gentle, as a matter of fact. Wouldn't you say so, Miss Fellows?
And as Miss Fellows pointed out earlier,
Marianne Levian said with icy sweetness,
we must not regard Timmy as being in any way subhuman, merely as unusual in certain physical aspects.
So, of course, you'd be delighted to let your own small child come in and play with him, said Hoskins. Except you don't happen to have any children, do you, Dr. Levian?
No, of course you don't.
What about you, Mannheim? Do you have a little boy you'd like to volunteer for us?
Mannheim looked stung. Stiffly he said, that's neither here nor there, Dr. Hoskins. I assure you that if I had been fortunate enough to have children, I wouldn't hesitate to offer to help.
I understand your resentment at what you see as outside interference, Doctor, but by transporting Timmy to our era, you've taken the law into your own hands. It's time now to consider the full implications of what you've done. You can't keep the boy in solitary confinement simply because there's a scientific experiment going on here. You can't, Dr. Hoskins.
Hoskins closed his eyes and took several deep breaths.
All right, he said finally. Enough of this. I concede the point. We'll get a playmate for Timmy. Somewhere, somehow. His eyes blazed with sudden fury. Unlike either of you, I do have a child. And if necessary, I'll bring him in to be Timmy's friend. My own son, if I have to. Is that enough of a guarantee for you? Timmy won't be left lonely and miserable any longer. All right? All right?
Hoskins glowered at them. Now that that's settled, do you have any further requests to make?
Or can we be permitted to continue with our scientific work in peace?